This is Audible.
Sounds True presents Rising Strong as a Spiritual Practice, recorded in front of a live audience with Brené Brown. It's my great joy, delight, and honor to be able to introduce now Brené Brown. Brené Brown is a researcher storyteller. And if you haven't heard this descriptor before, I hadn't until I really started delving into Brené's work. I don't think it's a descriptor that has ever been used before. And when I mentioned that to Brené, she said, well, what's the point of research if you can't bring forth the learning and bring forth the stories? Yet I think most of us historically have thought of research as something quantitative. It's a bunch of numbers. But actually understanding the heart story that is behind the research and then communicating that in a powerful way through storytelling is just one of Brené's many gifts. And of course, we've experienced that gift in her three number one New York Times best-selling books, The Gifts of Imperfection, Daring Greatly, Rising Strong, and she shares the research she's done for the past 15 years into courage, vulnerability, shame, and empathy. She's inspired us here and millions to live more courageously, more wholeheartedly, to lead with our own vulnerability. And here today, Rising Strong as a Spiritual Practice, please join me in welcoming Brené Brown.
I'm so excited to be here. You know, it's so funny. Perspective is so interesting because last night I was telling Charlie, my fifth grader, I'm like, I'm going to Denver tonight, but I'm going to be home tomorrow. It'll probably be a little bit past your bedtime, but I'll come give you a kiss. He's like, why are you going to Denver? And I explained it didn't work out in April because of the weather. And then I'm, you know, going to do this now. He's like, I'm really sorry. I said, no, I think it's going to be fine. He goes, no, but I know it has to be really hard that you miss the snow. Like, I didn't even get it. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I know, it's really sad that they didn't let you come when it was snowing. Because that would have been so much more fun. And I was like, yeah, okay. Perspective, right? So thank y'all. I'm sorry that April was, it was funny because a lot of y'all sent me like tweets and Facebook, like, here's what it looks like today. Glad you're safe and warm. And it was like 96 in Houston. I was like, I'm okay. So this is new. This is something that I've been thinking about for a long time. Rising Strong is a Spiritual Practice. So what we're going to talk about today is spirituality and the intersection of spirituality with my work. And so I want to start by defining spirituality. And how many of y'all have read The Gifts of Imperfection? Y'all rock. Best audience ever. So I want to start with the definition of spirituality because I think definitions are really important. It doesn't tell you what spirituality needs to be for you, but it will tell you how I think of spirituality and what emerged from my data as the definition of spirituality. Because I think so much of the viciousness that we're seeing today in the world is about not understanding and not listening and not hearing. So I want to get real close up with this definition before we start. So that, again, it doesn't have to be your definition, but this is how I think about it, so that when I talk about rising strong or anything as a spiritual practice, you'll know what I mean. So I define spirituality as recognizing and celebrating that we are inextricably connected to one another by a power greater than all of us, and that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and belonging. That thing that is bigger than us, some people call it God. My father calls it fishing. My friend Chaz, who's the CFO in our companies, calls it scuba diving. People call that thing that's greater than us by different names. But I think that that's not where the separation or the difference comes from. I think one of the key pieces to spirituality that emerged, and I'll tell you why in a second, it was incredibly important for me to have a definition. I think one of the key pieces of spirituality is that core belief, that deeply, deeply held belief that we are inextricably connected to each other. That as much as we would like to be different and separate sometimes, that we just can't be. And that if there's pain somewhere in the world being held by someone we don't know or have never heard of, that pain in some way reverberates to us as well. And when joy is put out in the world, that also is something we share. So I think the most important piece for me in spirituality is this deeply held belief that we're connected to each other in an unbreakable way, regardless of how hard we try to break it every day. The reason why having a definition for spirituality was so important in my work is because it has emerged consistently from the beginning of my research as kind of an irreducible element of wholeheartedness. And that scared the shit out of me because I'm an academic and we don't talk about spirituality unless you're in the divinity school. We just don't talk about spirituality. And so it just started emerging over and over again that men and women who really live and love wholeheartedly have a pretty profound spiritual life. The problem and where it got tricky is what that spirituality looked like and felt like and smelt like. And, you know, that was different for everyone. And what they shared in common was that sense that we're connected and that sense there's something bigger than us. And this is the third key piece. And that thing that's bigger than us is rooted in love and belonging. When what holds us together is fear, that is not spirituality. When what holds us together and binds us together is hatred, shared hatred even for a different group of people, shared hatred for an idea or principle, that too is not spiritual. Spirituality is the connectedness that's rooted in love and belonging, which I think is important because love and belonging, absolute irreducible needs of men, women, and children. In the absence of love and belonging, there is always suffering. And so what scared me to death is when I stepped back and started looking at this, and you know, I have 200,000 pieces of data now. When I step back and look at that, basically the conclusion that I can draw is in an absence of any kind of spirituality, there is a sense of suffering. If we are not connected to each other in some way by something more important than us and something that's love. The byproduct of spirituality I found in my work is that spirituality brings a sense of perspective, meaning, and purpose to our lives. And that seems to be the biggest piece of what's missing in people who don't have a spiritual practice. And I have to say again, one of the most profound interviews I've ever done around spirituality, art and creativity was this person's thing that binds us, that's rooted in love and belonging, that's greater than us and connected us. And this was a deeply, deeply spiritual person who never talked in a traditional, I'm a member of the Episcopal Church, like we're a pretty traditional, we have a traditional vibe, you know, around spirituality. But when I left that interview, I thought, I don't think he mentioned God one time. I don't think he said higher power. I don't think he said Allah. I don't think, I mean, nothing. But there was deep spirituality. And so I think we restrict ourselves when we start talking about, I'm not talking about faith. I'm not talking about dogma. I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking really about spirit. And so this is the foundation from which we're going to build today. Any practice that you engage in your lives, any practice that we engage in on a regular basis that reminds us of our unbreakable connection to other people and reminds us of something greater, something that's love, something that's belonging, something that's connection, can be a spiritual practice. And it doesn't matter what that thing is. Teaching. Any teachers in the audience? Whoop, There's some woo-woo teachers in the audience. Teaching can be a spiritual practice. Any therapists in the audience? This is Colorado. This should make all you non-therapists very nervous because there's like one of them for every one of you here. If you're nervous, I'll give you a hint. Look for the clogs. That's how I know I'm with my people. Because normally I have on clogs. But I wore my shit kickers today because... Yeah, but let's see again. Show of hands. How many therapists in the room? It's a lot. People are like, oh my God. You're disproportionately represented in the state of Colorado, I have to tell you, and California. That practice of sitting with people, not leading them, not following them, but standing next to them and accompanying them on their journey, spiritual practice. Leading, how many leaders and organizations in this room? I spend 90% of my time now in probably Fortune 500 companies working with leaders. That's what I do. The majority of my work is around now. Leading can be a spiritual practice. If you're leading from heart, the problem is a lot of folks lead from hurt, not lead from heart. They lead from the wound instead of the spirit. And so that's something that people are really hungry to change, and I think we're at a tipping point. We'll change it. So when I talk about a spiritual practice, are y'all kind of on board with what I'm talking about? I'm not talking about a dogmatic way of approaching the world and a higher power or God. I'm talking about something in some ways that requires more. Because I can tell you that I don't always love that unbreakable connection to everybody. Am I alone? How many would be happy with an unbreakable connection with like-spirited people? And a broken connection with people who we don't like, agree with, and we want to punch in the face. Right? So, you know, someone asked me the other day, said, why do you go to church? My poor kids. It's hard because I make up all my own prayers, because anytime there's a prayer, like in the Book of Common Prayer, that I disagree with the language or what they're saying, I just change it. And then unlike what I did in my 30s, where I just whispered it, like when I got into my 40s, I was like just reading it louder than everyone else to make sure everyone was aware that there would be a better way to do this. So like when I say the Our Father, I say, and deliver us instead of deliver us from evil, which I always think of. How many of you grew up around, I think it was Frosty the Snowman that came on. Remember when it just came on once a year, you caught it or you didn't catch it? And then there was that kind of the bad guy with the tall hat and the mustache that locked Frosty in a greenhouse to melt. That's what I think of every time you see the word evil. I think of that guy. So it's got no impact for me. So I always say deliver us from fear and shame, because I think that's actually the source of evil. So for me, when people say, why do you go to church? Because you change all the prayers and like, I go to church only for two reasons. Actually three, probably. To pass the peace, because I'm part of a denomination where we say peace be with you. To pass the peace, to sing with, and to share the rail where we get communion with people who I would never talk to any other time than at church because I don't like what they believe in and stand for. Really. And that's the only reason I go to church, so that once a week, I break bread with them, I sing with them, and I offer them peace in their lives, and I receive the peace from them. Because there's got to be somewhere and something that's bigger than politics, bigger than ideology, bigger than, you know, bigger than hate. Really. There's got to be somewhere. That's why the belongings in that definition of spirituality, that thing bigger than us is grounded in love and belonging, because belonging is in our DNA to be a part of something bigger than us. And true belonging, you know what the hallmark of true belonging is? Descent. To be a part of something bigger than us with people we don't agree with. That's real belonging. And I think that's hard to get today without spirituality. So I'm going to tell a story because we are wired for story. And this is one of the principles of Rising Strong. that we're wired for story. And it's a great slogan. And it's been a great slogan for probably about 10 years. But in the last 5 years, we backed the slogan up with neurobiology, and we actually know that we're hardwired neurobiologically for story. We're wired for it. The brain absolutely recognizes the narrative pattern of beginning, middle, and end, and relies on story to understand how, when, and why to protect us when we're not safe. We have used story from the beginning of time. It's how we teach. It's how we express ourselves. It's how we gather. It's how we share a sense of belonging with each other. So I'm going to tell a story from my spiritual breakdown / awakening. I called it a spiritual breakdown. Therapists called it awakening. I like awakening, has a better ring. But this was kind of a pinnacle of that breakdown for me. And the thing I love about the Rising Strong process, which we'll talk about, is that it's not only a process to help us deal with struggle that we're in the present. It's a process that when I went into the research asking, what do men and women who are brave with their lives, who are vulnerable, who are courageous, the ones that say, I love you first, the ones that try new things, when they fall and experience failure and setback and disappointment and heartbreak, which you will if you're brave enough, those men and women who get back up and are even more courageous and more resilient as a result of their fall, what do they share in common? And every single one of the most resilient men and women I've interviewed share a process in common that I call Rising Strong. And we're going to go through the process today. And I'm going to tell a story first, because the thing I love about the process is the ability it gives us to not only deal with current struggle, but to look back on something hard that we went through and make sense of it in a way, even if it's 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So for me, I was in the middle of my spiritual awakening breakdown, and I was exhausted. I was scared. My work was just kind of catching on. I was still a huge subscriber to the belief that exhaustion is a status symbol that you should be proud of. And so this is, and I don't think there's any question for me, this was Easter weekend. It was actually Easter Monday. And my daughter had off school, Ellen, and I decided to take her to TCBY to get some yogurt and to hang out. Other schools were in session, and so it was really fun because we were there when other moms came with their kids after school. And we're sitting there, and I'm like looking around. I'm thinking, I should quit work. Maybe I should do like the full-time mom thing and do a side job. I know things are not right. I feel off. I feel exhausted, but I'm like, I love my work. There were no fathers. It was just really moms and daughters. And I was really looking at these kids. And Ellen had on, you know, a little outfit, and we had been outside, and she was kind of dirty. And these kids were amazing. They had these blunt haircuts, and everything was monogrammed. And I was like, this is what it looks like on the other side. I was like, I think this is maybe the life I want. And so we get our ice creams and we sit down, and my phone starts ringing. You know, and you can see people are like, and I'm like, don't get it. You're in the mother-daughter blunt hair monogram time. Like, don't answer it. Don't answer it. So I didn't answer it. And then like 2 minutes later, it started ringing again. I was like, I think it was a 503 area code. Whatever it wasn't Houston. I was like, maybe I should get it. And I'm like, hello? In my chipper, I'm not working voice. Hello? And on the other end, I hear, Dr. Brown, it's Jen. Are you okay? And so Jen is the speaking and event coordinator for the governor of Iowa. And event coordinators are an anxious group of people. Mostly because they have to deal with me and people like me. And so I was like, oh my God, because she was like, you could tell she was worked up. And she's like, Dr. Brown, are you okay? Are you okay? And I'm like, Jen, are you okay? And she's like, I am okay, but are you okay? I'm like, yes, I'm fine. What's going on? She goes, no, it's just you missed your flight. And, you know, there's no other flight tonight to Des Moines. And there's 2,000 people, including the governor of Iowa, that are going to be at this event tomorrow morning at 7:45. And you missed your flight. The travel people just called. And I was like, Jen, my flight is on April 15th at 3:00. And she's like, I know it's April 14th or whatever day, and it's 3:30. And I was like, yeah, but I don't understand. And she said, it is April 15th and it's 3:30 and your flight from Intercontinental left 30 minutes ago. You were not aboard. Therefore, I got notification from the travel department from the state of Iowa. I don't understand what's happening. And she's like, you missed your flight and you have to be here tomorrow. And I said, I do not understand what is happening right now. And at this point, Ellen's getting misty-eyed because, you know, she's scared. And I see these moms kind of pull their kids in closer. Like, don't look. It could be contagious. Like, and so finally, kind, wonderful Jen goes, you missed your flight and you are not going to be here for the governor and the 2,000 people that are showing up tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. Do you understand that? And I was like, oh my God. I mean, this is a reoccurring nightmare that I have, right? And I'm like, oh my God. It just put me naked in the airport. It would have been the complete nightmare. I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. I was like, oh my God, let me call you back. And I remember sitting there and I remember my hand being against the plate glass window and I could barely, like, I remember being dizzy, tunnel vision, my mouth was dry. I was just, I could not believe what was happening. So I said, Ellen, we've got to go. And so I grab Ellen and we jump in my car and I'm crying and I text Steve the emergency code, which is like, I don't care what you're doing. But no one's dead. Like, we had like a code, like, when you're married to me, you have to have the code and then one that's like, not the code, but it's still important. And so, Ellen's like, are you okay? I'm driving. Are you okay, Mom? Are you okay? And I'm like, no, Ellen, I've made a huge mistake. I've made a huge mistake. And she's like, Mom, but you always tell me that we make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. And I was like, I understand, Ellen, this is not like the kind of mistakes we talk about normally. This is like a really serious mistake. This is a very serious mistake. And she said, you know, I made a mistake on my spelling test and you looked at it yesterday and you said it was okay. And I said, and it is okay, Elle, but this is a very serious mistake. And she's really quiet and she's teary-eyed because she can tell there's panic. And she looks at me, I'm looking right in the rear mirror, and she looks at me and she goes, serious job, serious mistakes. I'm like, oh my God, I've given birth to Buddha. I'm like, I was like, oh no. We get home. Steve pulls up right behind us. He'd left work. He worked like 5 minutes from the house. He pulls up behind. He's like, how'd this happen? I was like, I don't know. I don't know what's happening. And so my speaking agent people are on the phone. And I'm panicked and I'm trying to pack a bag and how am I going to get there? And Steve's like, okay, it's a 15-hour drive. We're trying to figure it out. And the phone rings and it's the travel people. And they said, I do not know what is happening. And I was like, right? And she said, no, that part I get. And I sat and I was like, what do you mean? She goes, there is one seat on a flight tonight from Houston to Des Moines direct. And we got it for you, but we didn't even know this flight existed. And so when I talked to the people at United, they said they usually don't make this run, but for some reason, for the next 3 weeks, they're having an 8 p.m. flight from Houston to Des Moines direct. And so I was like, awesome. She goes, too soon. Mm-mm. No, she said, it's too soon to celebrate. I was like, that's great. So I look at Steve and I'm like, by now I'm completely strung out. So he's like, let me drive you to the airport. I'm going to go get Charlie, get packed, pull Charlie out of his preschool. I'll take you, the kids, to the airport. I don't want you driving to the airport. And I was like, okay. So he gets back. I'm packed. He's getting ready to take me to Intercontinental. We get in the car and I start crying and I'm like, oh my God, Steve, I'm not prepared to leave at all. And he's like, Jesus, what? And I said, you know, I haven't put out Ellen's clothes. There's nothing for dinner. And he's like, okay. Cause usually what I had done up to that point in my life is I had little clothespins that had the day of the week on them. And then I would put a clothespin, like if I was going to be gone Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I'd put Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday out for Ellen. And I would try to make some food and put it in the freezer or put it in the refrigerator for while I'm gone. Because that made me feel better. And so Steve's like, Brene, I don't want to kick you while you're down. I was like, okay. And I remember he put his hand on my leg. He's driving. And he's like, I was like, you know, really, I usually try to leave y'all something to eat. I know you've got both kids holding down the fort, job, you're on call. And he's like, we don't eat that shit when you're gone. And Ellen wears whatever she wants while you're not here. And then Ellen in the back, she goes, yeah, it's so fun when you're gone because we go to Double Dave's and get pepperoni rolls and ranch dressing every night you're gone. I literally was on the floorboard of my car in the fetal position sobbing. I couldn't, and it explained so much because my friend Wendy would send these funny pictures of Ellen to me and I was like, look, Ellen's over at the Berks playing dress up. That's so fun. But no, that's what Ellen wore to school. Ellen wore like striped tights and a cape to school. Which also explained why when I got back in town, teachers always say, oh, how was your trip? And I never understood how they knew I was out of town. It was all coming into place. So ultimately, this ends up being liberation for me. But it was a painful walk from the floorboard of the car to liberation. Let me tell you what happened when I got to Des Moines. I got to Des Moines. The next morning, I remember I always say the same prayer before I talk. And I remember saying this prayer, God, give me the strength and courage to delight in your will and walk in your way with gladness and singleness of heart. And so strength is just like, give me the strength to just do this and do it well and honor the people's time that are in front of me. And give me the courage to be honest and not try to hustle for my worthiness or, you know, pretend like I'm smart or pretend like I'm this. Let me just be honest. And so I remember I was talking about anxiety, how anxiety shows up in teams. That was the talk. And what's interesting about the talk is anxiety shows up two ways for us. This comes out of straight out of Bowen Family Systems. Anxiety shows up for us in two ways. Here's what's interesting. Anxiety is never a function of individuals. It's always a function of groups because anxiety is one of the most contagious affects we experience. It's a function of groups or families or teams because it's so contagious. How many of you have ever had the experience where things are going okay in a small group at work and then one person comes in who's really anxious, who's in a lot of fear and stress, and then it takes off like wildfire? Raise your hand if you've had that experience. Right, because anxiety is a function of groups and teams. Any organism that's, it's, you know, more than one, it spreads. What's interesting is that we have a very patterned way of dealing with anxiety that's very much rooted in our families of origin. So there are two patterned ways of dealing with anxiety. We either overfunction or we underfunction. And so overfunctioners have a tendency in anxiety to get controlling, micromanage, focus on everyone else's problems, don't deal with their own. They know what's best for everyone. Control, control, control. Underfunctioners have a tendency to get less competent under great stress and anxiety. They don't show up fully. They forget things. Their work product or what they produce is not at the level that they normally can produce it. They can forget. So let me take you back to the weekend before I missed my flight. I'm at the Jung Center in Houston giving a talk on anxiety. I know the irony is so thick. And I'm talking about overfunctioning and underfunctioning. And I'm talking about how it's really important to understand those patterns of behavior that we turn to and how they don't represent our best selves, but they're what we developed in our families of origin. Let me ask you this. Raise your hand and keep your hand up if you're an overfunctioner in anxiety and stress. Keep it up. How many of you who've got your hands up right now, and for those of y'all listening to this, it's about 70% in here, which would be right for who comes to a talk like this. Just saying, keep your hand up, keep your hand up. Okay, how many of you who are overfunctioners are firstborns as well? Okay, so birth order can have a lot to do in how we're parented and how, so I'm the oldest of four, codenamed Sister Superior. You have a tendency to get very controlling and micromanaging when you grow up hearing, if you leave the toilet seat up, your sisters will drown. Like, you have a tendency to think you have a control over a lot of things that you don't really have control over. And so I gave this talk at the Jung Center. After this talk, I had told them that I needed to go straight home. And lo and behold, they have a little booth for me to sit up and take questions from people one-on-one. And I was like, oh my God, what, I've really got to get home, but I'm going to do this. And so I said, I'm going to sit there for 45 minutes. So I'm in hour number two of the Q&A. And a young woman comes up to me and says, can you help me understand more about underfunctioning? I think I'm an underfunctioner. And I say back, I really can't help you understand underfunctioning. I don't understand underfunctioning because I'm an overfunctioner, which seems like a really shitty label to put on me when I'm just doing everyone's work who underfunctions. Funny, except super hurtful for her. I mean, she looked hurt. And I was like, I'm sorry. And she goes, no, I understand. I said, no, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I wasn't, you know, what are you going to say now? You're the asshole who says, I wasn't supposed to be here. They were supposed to get off an hour ago. I was like, I'm sorry. That was not a thoughtful response. And I got to be honest with you. Like, I'm such an overfunctioner that I don't really understand underfunctioning as well. I think it's just ways that we try to control our anxiety. And she's like, okay, and she left. So I get home, you know, I miss my kids, tuck-ins and everything because I'm late. I wake up the next morning. I'm so, like, emotional hangover, you know, and I'm thinking, God, I was shaming to somebody. I can do a lot of things, but I'm pretty good at not shaming people. I have my moments, but I'm aware of it, so I work on it really hard. And so I really got on my knees and said, God, please, you know, I prayed for the wrong thing. I said, please help me understand underfunctioning. Please help me understand what it means to underfunction so that I can tell people what that is. Like, not the prayer that should have happened, which is relieve me from my assholeness, but just because I thought in that moment that I answered like that because I didn't understand it. I didn't think about what was really happening for me. So I remember saying my prayer the morning before my talk in Des Moines and thinking, what does strength and courage look like today? And I said, oh my God, you answered my prayer. You showed me what underfunctioning looked like. And I almost missed this event. I have been so careful about what I pray for from that moment forward. But I thought, you know what I need to do? I need to tell this story. So I got up and I just said, let me tell you what over and under functioning can look like. Because I can speak to both now. And it was really the first time in my life that I'd ever really under functioned in that state to that magnitude. And so I remember telling the story and saying, almost didn't make it here last night. And then I see Jen in the back by the AV booth, tears streaming down her face. The audience thought the story was great and funny. And there was a whole group of people yelling, I'm like, do y'all know how long it takes to drive here? And they're like, we have a pool back here that says you drove here. How did you get here? And people were laughing. Jen, every time I looked at Jen, she was just like, too soon, still too soon. And when I got home, I had to track that young woman down. And I sent her a very long email, gave her my phone number and said, call me if you want to talk about it. And really apologized and said, I don't think I understood, but I think I understand now. So when I look at the Rising Strong process that has three pieces, the reckoning, the rumble, and the revolution, and I think about that story, here's what the Rising Strong process is. Men and women who have the highest levels of resilience, this is what they go through in the midst of struggle. The first thing is the reckoning. They recognize when they're in difficult emotion, and they get curious about what that emotion is. And it seems so easy, except how many of you in here were raised to get really curious about your emotions and ask a lot of questions? It's Colorado. I'm going to give it 20 people. Show of hands. How many of you were raised? 20. And there's 1,400 in here, Tammy? So 1,400 minus 20. So that leaves 1,300, 1,380 of us. How does this resonate with you? I know that's hard. Suck it up and let's get some stuff done. So there's the other, right? So that reckoning is really about, I have been hooked by something. I've been hooked by emotion, and I need to dig into what's happening. I can't just keep steamrolling over what I'm in right now, because I'm going to start making decisions. I'm going to start treating people in ways that don't align with my values and who I want to be. So the reckoning is about recognizing emotion. Here's what's tricky about the reckoning. We have asked over the last 15 years, thousands of people to identify and write down every emotion they can recognize in themselves and articulate. What do you think the average number is? I hear a lot of fives. Three. Three is the average number of emotions that adults that we've interviewed, that really very broad sample, happy, sad, pissed off. It's pretty clear. We just recently spent a lot of time going through a lot of data about what we call kind of emotional fluency. What does it take to really develop an emotional vocabulary to be fluent in, you know, in emotion? Guess how many we really need to be able to identify and articulate? 30. So it's 10x what we know. And what's been really exciting for me as a researcher is this year, two huge studies have come out by other researchers acknowledging the importance of what we call emotional granularity. The ability to, at a very granular level, recognize an emotion. So instead of happy, it's joyful, it's surprised, it's something deeper. Instead of angry, it's I'm feeling regret, I'm feeling disappointed, I'm feeling fearful, I'm feeling shame, I'm feeling guilt, I'm feeling humiliated, I'm feeling embarrassed, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling uncertain. You know, and so to me, the biggest task of the reckoning is to recognize that you're in emotion and then be able to articulate with some specificity what it is you're feeling. So one of the analogies I'd like to use all the time is imagine that you have a pain that's so horrendous in your right shoulder that it literally takes your breath away. And it comes and it goes, but when it comes, it's like a knife stab. And so you're like, I can't take it anymore. I mean, this knocks the wind out of me. So you go to your doctor and you get to your doctor's office and you look at her and all of a sudden your mouth is duct taped shut and your hands are tied behind your back. And she said, what's going on? How do you articulate it to her? What do you do? I mean, literally, what do? You're in agony, right? And she's like, I don't understand what's happening. And you're like, you know, you're trying to explain it. That's what happens to us when we don't have an emotional vocabulary. That's what happens to us when I'm standing across from Steve. And I'm just like, no, you told me you were going to pick all that stuff up on the way home. I don't understand it. You know what I mean? Like, I get that we're running the house together. That means actually doing shit together. That means like you do some stuff and I do some stuff. That means together. And he's been in the house for 30 seconds. How many of you have had that experience? When if I had... I have to tell y'all what I just saw. Is that your partner, your husband? She grabbed his elbow and raised his hand involuntarily for him. That is a first. That is awesome. That will go down in my history as one of the most amazing things ever. We've all done that, right? Yelled at a kid instead of Steve walks in the door and says, like, I know you just got here, but I am in such deep fear about this thing going on at work. I have to talk to you about it. And you know what he would say? He's like, okay, let's talk about it. Let's go. He's just standing there holding the stuff. Go. How many of you would prefer that 100% to the me just beating on him when he comes home? Right. Because it's a granularity issue. It's about the ability. Let me ask this question. When you get hooked by something, when something hard happens, let me just ask, how do you know when you've been hooked by hard emotion? Pain. Who said pain? Okay. Tell me what it feels like. How do you know you're in it?
Pain in my heart, pain in my stomach. It hurts.
Okay, it hurts. Heavy stomach, heavy heart, it hurts. How else do you know?
Blame and denial.
Okay, blame and denial. Blame and denial is how we react to it. But tell me how you know you're in it. Who said hot flash? Okay, what else?
Sweaty armpits.
Sweaty armpits.
Crying.
Cry.
Stop breathing.
Distraction, hyperventilate.
Inability to think.
Or move, tightness in your chest.
Procrastinate.
Again, that is a behavior that's a response to the reason they call emotions feelings is because the first place we experience them is in our bodies. So the first response to emotion is physiological, always. So I want you to think for a moment about something. Let's do it this way. You're driving and you're going 80 on the freeway and an 18-wheeler's in front of you and that 18-wheeler jackknifes and you are able to make it around that truck without hitting it. No one's hurt. No one gets hit. What's happening in your body right now? I just want you to close your eyes and imagine your body.
Shaking,
adrenaline, sweaty, tunnel vision, tension, focus, laser focus. Shallow breathing. Those are the exact same things we experience in difficult emotion. That's our body's response of saying something hard is happening and I am literally pulling in every physiological resource I can pull in right now in case you have to fight or run. That's our body's response to a hard thing. And that's what happens. Imagine if we work together and we are walking out of a meeting and you say, boy, that was a tough meeting. I go, yeah, you sucked in that meeting. And walk away. What would you feel? Laser focus, heart racing. What's happening? Anxiety, the same thing. And so the reckoning part of this process is about recognizing you're in emotion, getting curious about what it is that you're feeling, and stopping for a second as opposed to responding behaviorally to what you don't even understand yet. Because here's the thing, when something hard happens, the brain asks for one thing above all else. It wants a story to explain what's happening. It wants you to say, we just walked out of the meeting. I said it was tough. Brene said I sucked in it and walked away. She hates me. I screwed something up. I'm probably going to get fired and I'm probably in really big trouble. And then your brain goes, okay, gotcha. Thank you for the story. Here's a huge chemical reward that will make you feel a sense of calm. It's a chemical reward that we get when we give the brain a story. And now you have a story that you're going to work off of. Oh, my God. Steve, hey, it's me. Listen, you didn't buy those new fishing poles, did you? Because I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose my job today. No, really, seriously, I'm really getting fired today. I'm not kidding you. No, I know this is the fourth time I've said that in a month, but this time I mean it. Because the thing is that the brain gives us that reward regardless of the accuracy of the story. The brain doesn't care if the story is true or not true. The brain just wants a story that minimizes variables, minimizes uncertainty, and gives us a bad guy and a good guy. That's all the brain wants. The brain does not like oh, there's a very big swirl of complicated variables happening here that you need, you know, we'd all be dead based on evolution if that's the way our brain works. We would not have survived this long if the brain only kicked into survival once we gave it a nuanced, balanced story. It doesn't work that way. And so we have to be able to recognize emotion, and we have to recognize what it is, try to start to dig into what we're feeling. So for me, the story I made up in the car when Steve said, "We don't eat what you make, I miss my flight," the story I made up in that moment, I know exactly what I told myself, because you can imagine my brain was scrambling, like, you screwed up work and your family does not actually need you. So you've abandoned your family for your work, which now you've screwed up. Now you, you know, and so my story that I made up in the floorboard of the car on the way to the airport was, I do not have tight enough control over everything. I am losing control. I need more control. More control is the answer to this problem. I need to control my calendar. I need to control what the kids wear when I'm out of town. I need to control the fact that if people see my kids eating Double Dave's pepperoni rolls with ranch dressing 3 days a week if I'm gone for 3 nights, that makes me look bad. If Ellen goes to school with these crazy outfits, what are people going to think about me? They're like, oh, yeah, Ellen dresses like that because her mom's got the big career where she's talking about parenting to people. is this a story y'all would make up or not? Yeah. The more that I may be away, the more perfect things better be at home to justify the fact that I'm away. So the answer to this whole thing is more control. And y'all saw how well that was serving me. And so the next part of the reckoning process is the rumble. And so I call that first story we make up, that first story we give our brain to stay safe, the shitty first draft. And I borrowed that from my hero, Anne Lamott. Love her. If y'all don't know her, you should read Bird by Bird. It's one of the best books in the world. It's where she talks about the writing process. And what she says is that every writer starts with a shitty first draft. And in that shitty first draft, you should hold nothing back. You should let your angry, most terrible, bratty 5-year-old loose on the page. Because your 5-year-old's your truth teller. And so I call this first start of the rumble, that first story we tell ourselves, it is our shitty first draft. SFD? For churches. Children. Unless you're a member of the Episcopal Church, which we're good with shitty first draft. So the thing about the rumble is the most resilient men and women don't deny that there's an SFD. They actually, 70% of them, this is crazy to me, write it down. They write down that crazy first story. And I'm going to tell you why. And it was so clear to me even before I found James Pennebaker's research. What happens when I write down on a piece of paper, I have missed my flight? I am devastated because the color-coordinated clothespins that dictate what Ellen should wear every day were not on her clothes, and I had no casseroles or anything in the refrigerator for my family. What I really need is more control. What happens when you write that down? Right, you're just making the universal sign for that's the wrong story. Yes, you look at that story, and what do you think? Something's not right. Right? Something's off on this story. So James Pennebaker, who is a researcher at the University of Texas at Austin, who has studied trauma and writing for the last 40 years, found that men and women who write about their trauma heal profoundly faster than men and women who don't. And he's prescriptive about it. It's not men and women who write a book about it. It's men or women who write 4 or 5 times for 15 or 20 minutes, period. Have incredibly different physical and mental health outcomes from trauma than people who don't write about it. The mythology is, if I write about something, I give it power. Oh my God, I'm not going to put this crazy story down on paper. But when you write it down, you give yourself power because you have externalized it on a piece of paper. And now it doesn't live inside you and control you. You have it in front of you. You can get your prefrontal cortex back online. and use that rationalizing executive center to really look at that and say, is control the answer here? So for me, I didn't have this. I didn't know this process when this happened. This story happened in 2007. What I had was probably the best thing, a therapist who had me write it down. And so that's the rumble. We start to rumble with the story. We start to rumble with that SFD. What's true here? What's not true here? What's fear-based? What's real? This is a really interesting time in the world to talk about conspiracy theories. Do you know how researchers define conspiracy? It's so profoundly helpful for me. A conspiracy is a story where you're missing data points, so you fill them in with belief and fear. Right. A conspiracy is simply a story where there's some missing data, and you fill in the story with your own fear and your own beliefs. And the thing that I can tell you for sure about human nature is this. In the absence of data, we will always make up stories. How many of you have ever led a team through change at work? What is the hardest part of doing that? The rumors. Because people are fearful. They don't understand what's happening. We're not wired for change. You as a leader may not even be able to tell them anything beyond what you're telling them, right? Or you may know it, but it has not been communicated out yet. And so there's an absence of data, so people start making up stories. And what stories do they make up? Conspiracies. They make up the conspiracies that help them understand, look, your brain just wants this. Your brain's just saying, look, tell me who's bad, tell me who's good, tell me who's dangerous, and tell me who's safe. Don't tell me about the guy who traditionally you thought has been pretty good for the last 10 years. So you're questioning yourself about really, could he really be that dangerous of a leader? Don't tell me about that. I don't want to know about that. That doesn't help me protect you. Bad, I give you two slots. You file the thing into bad, good, safe, dangerous, against you or for you. That is the only story I will reward you for telling me. Any ambiguity, uncertainty, any complex variables, I don't care. Because that keeps me from doing my job. And my job is to protect you. The problem is you want to look at the brain and say, right, but you got hired in the beginning of the human species. And our brain is literally three times bigger than it was when you were hired. And my capacity for emotional being and emotional connection has like quadrupled just by the size of the brain parts that control for that. So what you don't understand anymore is that vulnerability is the birthplace of connection, trust, intimacy, love, belonging, and meaning. So I have to be vulnerable to have a life worth living. You cannot keep going off every time I'm vulnerable. That is not the same as a dinosaur running into the cave to eat me. And your brain says, good, bad, safe, unsafe. And that's what you're, you know, because that's it. We're not changing that part of our brain. But men and women with the most resilience have hacked into it. They have hacked into it and they understand what's happening. And they use it. It took me 5 minutes on the floorboard of that car to figure out how this entire thing was Steve's fault. How many of you have seen the blame video on from the Royal Society for the Arts? Just, it's terrible. It's like a 2-minute video about blame. Just Google Brené Brown, RSA, blame. I'm a blamer. And so the story I was making up is that I need more control and Steve is really trying to sabotage my career. Because I had asked him in a 5-minute conversation, like unloading the dishwasher, do you think I should get an assistant? And he said, I think you'd hate that. Because you don't like people here at the house. I'm a very private person. I'm very introverted. I'm very private. On the floorboard, I said, he's trying to sabotage it by making sure I don't have an assistant. And not eating that squash casserole. He hates my career. And so that was part of the story I made up. More control, including over Steve. My husband, who is like, I'm like, I want to write a book about shame, and for some reason no one will publish it. And he's like, maybe you should self-publish. I'm like, do you think that's bad? And he goes, I think that's amazing. I think it's great. And I was like, do we have the money? And he goes like, no, but we'll borrow it or something. But it's important. I mean, this is a guy who supported me. We've been together for 30 years. Yeah, I mean, like, but that was my story. So when I look back and think more control, including over Steve, who's trying to sabotage my career, I know that doesn't work. So we have to really start rumbling with what's underneath there. What is really true? What do I really need to understand? And what I really need to understand is my life is completely out of control. I'm trying to control things like casseroles and tights for Ellen for school because I feel like I have no control over my actual life. I'm scared to say no because if I say no, all these opportunities will disappear. Because anytime you take care of yourself, you have to pay for that somehow. And there's a lot of rumble in there. I had to rumble with, my life is out of control. The perfectionism is literally killing me. It's not serving me. And in terms of anxiety and over and under functioning, now that I know what it feels like to under function, I think over functioning can probably be more corrosive in teams and with the people I work with than maybe even under-functioning. Because when you under-function and you miss things or you don't show up, there's a clear sign that something's wrong. But for those of us who over-function, how many of you would agree that we can pretend for a lot longer that we've got our shit together? Yes or no? Because one thing we do is we act like we're doing everything, but what we're really doing is destroying team morale usually because we get very judgmental. We focus on other people's problems and we never look at our own stuff. And so for me, that rumble really became about, I've got to get off. I've got to step out of my life for a minute and figure out why I'm making every decision I'm making right now in my life based on what other people will think. Saying yes to events I really shouldn't be doing, the meatloaf, the tights, and that was a hard rumble. The revolution part of the Rising Strong process is integration. And I absolutely think this is the heart of spirituality. Integration, like the word integration comes from the Latin word integrare, and it means to make whole. It just dawned on me like a couple of weeks ago that that's where integers comes from, I guess. Integrate, is that true? It must be. So yeah, that's a story I'm willing to make up and stand by. Yeah. Integrare, integers, integrate, to make whole. And so how do we integrate? The revolution happens the minute you really dig into that hard learning and you integrate what you've learned into your life. You actually say, you know what? This is a part of me. This unwillingness to say no. This concern more for what Ellen's teachers think about my job than what Ellen wants to wear in school. This thing where Steve's the bad guy all the time, I get afraid because he's the safest person in my life because he loves me the most and I treat him the worst when I'm afraid. These are things I have to own. And I have to own them and I have to fold them in to my life and to who I am so I can own them and change them. Because the whole key to rising strong is if you own the story, you can write the ending. If you deny the story owns you. I grew up hearing the saying, fifth generation Texan, you can never run from trouble. There ain't no place that far. And I think that's the rising strong piece. I believe that's from Mark. No, I'm kidding. That's not. That's from my grandpa. But it should be in the Bible somewhere, I think. Because it's very clear. Like you can't run from trouble. There's not any place you can go that's that far away. That's the story owning piece. That's the revolution piece of the Rising Strong process is the minute you own that story. And I think writing is a part of owning. I think writing is also, Penny Baker's research doesn't show that, but for me, I believe that when you write it down, if you looked on my iPhone right now, you would see I have an SFD notes list. There's probably 30 of them in there. where when you write it down, you're like, I cannot pretend that I am not telling this amazingly crazy story and behaving